This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly, I'm Tom Clark. As voters across America start to consider their next president, does authenticity now count for more than judgment in winning the White House? We look across the pond at the early stages of the race where the unlikely frontrunner among the Republicans is Donald Trump. Meanwhile, the Democrat favourite Hillary Clinton continues to lose ground to self-styled socialist Bernie Sanders. So what's going on? Also this week, as the Ulster Unionist Party quits the multi-party executive in Northern Ireland, we'll hear what that means for the delicate power-sharing arrangement at Stormont. But joining me first are Ewan McCaskill and, in Washington DC, Dan Roberts. A warm welcome to you both. Now, it may be more than a year until Americans go to the polls to elect their new president, but the race to succeed Barack Obama is already well underway. Dan Roberts, there are some familiar names in the mix, but what looked like being a straight Bush versus Clinton battle again is now looking like something more complicated, isn't it?
Yes, it's getting ever more fascinating by the week at the moment, with both the Republican and the Democratic primary races in complete flux. I mean, the Republicans, most strikingly, because of Donald Trump's surge over the last month or two. But it's not just him who's eclipsed the establishment candidates like Jeb Bush, but even complete unknowns like this neurosurgeon Ben Carson, who's never even been a politician before, is now polling second in the average of Republican primary voters. And then on the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton still out in front quite comfortably at the national level, but behind not only in New Hampshire, which is the second primary vote to happen, but crucially, she's also now in danger of falling behind in Iowa, which is the first to go to the polls at the beginning of February, to Bernie Sanders, who is a politician, he's a senator, but has very much been on the outside of the mainstream. So both races completely convulsed by this rejection of mainstream candidates.
Ewan, first of all, let's just focus in on Trump. People who Europeans have said wouldn't make suitable presidents, like George W. Bush or like Ronald Reagan, have become president. Is he someone else who could do the same thing?
I find it extraordinary that he's in this position, and I doubt it can last. Trump and Sanders and, you know, Jeremy Corbyn, and we've seen it in Greece and Spain. It's all part of this anti-establishment, anti-austerity, anti-spin in the old establishment. So you can see parallels across the continents. But what will happen to Trump is, you know, come Iowa, maybe he'll win. Iowa throws up strange candidates. Then it moves on to New Hampshire, you know, South Carolina, Florida. By the time they reach New Hampshire, the Republican Party will have come back to its senses, and it will be Jeb Bush or Marco Rubio or maybe Scott Walker. It'll be somebody mainstream rather than, Trump will be history.
And why, Dan, is Trump so much more dangerous, if you agree that he is, for the Republican Party than I don't know, Bush Jr. Or Reagan?
Well, I think he, first off, I would agree with you, and I think that he probably won't last the distance. But paradoxically, one of the things that it will probably help is the very well-known candidates like Jeb Bush, because at the moment he's crowding out the quite a strong field beneath him of people like Marco Rubio, who's a former governor, Scott Walker, who's a governor, Rand Paul. These are all candidates who are expected to do quite well. But aren't well-known yet, and they're getting very little airtime because Donald Trump is sucking up all the media attention. So I think that it probably will revert back, as Ewan says, to one of the front runners, but quite possibly the most establishment of them all, which is Jeb Bush, simply because he's the only one who's managing to survive this onslaught from Trump. To answer your question about how he compares, say, to George W. Bush or Reagan, I think it's a bit unfair on George W. Bush and Reagan. I mean, both were pretty well-established politicians in their own right. George W. Bush had been governor of the largest U.S. state, and Reagan had been governor of California, and they represented. They certainly sought election on quite moderate tickets. They were became known later for, in Reagan's case, quite right wing economics, and in W's case, quite hawkish foreign policy. But Donald Trump starts way out to the right on a lot of these things even before the election's begun, and I think has enraged a lot of people with some pretty racy, some would say racist, takes on immigration and women. And he, I think, really is very much the anti-politician. He's not right-wing, he's just off the scale.
And isn't there a sense with him as well, Ewan, that he's been a bit all over the place on subjects? I heard that, I know now he's running quite hard against immigration, but that he's been relatively favourable to it in the past.
Yeah, he's totally inconsistent. Again, it plays into this, anti-establishment, anti-politics feel that has been around in America longer than it's been around in Europe. But it's also what you said at the outset. I mean, the election's still a year away, and although the journalists and political classes are excited by the prospect of who the candidates are, it's wrong to assume that a lot of the American public will be familiar with some of the candidates. Like if you ask the average Joe in New York who about Scott Walker, I think they'd be sort of pushed to give you an answer. Whereas Trump has this name recognition.
Yeah,
because they've seen him on TV, on the reality show, and because he's an entrepreneur and all the rest of it. So quite often it will come down to sort of this combination of immediate name recognition. Plus, he's a sort of anti-establishment figure.
The challenge, though, for the rest of them is to try and get back into this, whether it's at New Hampshire or the next stop down the road. One of them needs to kind of break through, because at the moment it's a very fractured field, isn't it, below Donald Trump at the top. And I'm reading that this means that some of them are taking some really quite extreme positions on things, almost just to grab the attention.
Yes, I think there's always been an element of that in Republican primaries. You have to appeal to the base, and that quite often drags candidates to the right, particularly on social issues. Abortion is the one where we've seen probably the most stark examples of that from otherwise previously quite moderate candidates.
So people saying, get rid of the exemption for rape and that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. I think that just to play devil's advocate here, the one thing I would say as a positive about both the candidates, sort of Trump and also Sanders in the Democratic race, is that it's not just that they're anti-establishment, they're also, I think, tapping into something which is familiar in Europe as well, which is this sense in which the social mobility has completely broken down, and the fruits of the recovery, such that it is, have all gone to
people like Donald Trump.
Exactly. That's the great irony in Trump's case, is he's an emblem of social meritocracy. He's not terribly convincing. He's the son of a sort of property billionaire or millionaire. He became a billionaire himself. But he nonetheless, convincingly or otherwise, presents himself as a voice of that disenfranchised middle-class America that just feels the game's rigged. And one has to say, when you look at the economic data about the income distribution since the banking crash, they're right. The game is rigged. And I think that anybody who can successfully tap into that on both the right and the left, because it's felt by both Democrats and Republican voters, I think is in with a real shout here. Now, I don't think any of these candidates are quite crossover potential. In fact, quite the reverse. They appall, Sanders appalls Republicans because he's seen as far too left-wing, and Trump the counter. But somebody will tap into this and realize that this is not a left-right issue. This is a sort of class issue, and realize that the middle class is feeling left out. And I think that's potentially very interesting.
Do you agree with that, Ewan?
I do, yeah. I think Dan's right. And also this idea of your politics is something that about entitlement, and what we'll probably end up with is people have been talking about this for the last year or two, is a Hillary Clinton Jeb Bush contest, and you can't get any more sense of entitlement than that. You think the population of the states is, what was it, 300 million or and yet they end up with
two families,
two dynasties. And that idea appalls me that, you know, you've got 300 million people and they can't come up with new candidates.
Let's just move to the Democratic race then. I mean, even more so than with Jeb Bush, I mean, it was seen as completely sewn up for Hillary, wasn't it? And I think some of Obama's aides were moving over to work for her. And then I don't know whether it's that sense of entitlement or this long-running saga with the emails that eventually came out this week that have landed her in a bit of trouble.
Well, it's funny. A phrase that's sort of cropping up now in America is that this is a rerun of 2008. At this juncture in 2007, Hillary was about 30 points ahead of Obama, and then she just lost it. And it was partly because she's too cautious. You know, she's giving speeches that were vacuous, full of platitudes, cliches, not wanting to offend anybody. Mm. And Obama was giving quite dynamic speeches, passionate speeches. And it caught up with her. It was only towards the end of her campaign when she'd lost that her emotion and passion started to come through. Mm. The famous speech at the end about the glass ceiling. And I was hoping that this time we'd see she would have learned from that. But she seems to be, again, adopted this fairly cautious approach. And the emails haven't helped.
I mean, there wasn't any kind of candidature exploding thing in them, was there?
No, they're not. The emails themselves have been fairly uncontentious. Again, for the political classes, it's quite funny to read what our friend and former Guardian columnist, Sidney Blumenthal, appears in it quite a lot.
David Miliband,
insights into what she thinks about the passing remarks about individual British politicians like Cameron. But there's no bombshells in it. There's nothing that really should damage her or dent her campaign. It's just this. I think she will win in the end. The big question is whether Joe Biden comes in, which I suspect he probably will. But again, in 2008, he withdrew after Iowa when he only got 1% of the vote. Right. So I'm not sure that he will necessarily unseat Clinton.
There was a report, Dan, wasn't there, this week that maybe Obama had given the wink to Joe Biden it would be okay to run if he wanted to.
Oh, I think that's almost certainly the case. I don't think Obama would want to be seen to be anointing successors. And indeed, I think there was a little bit of embarrassment in the White House that they had overly enthusiastically been seen to endorse Hillary Clinton early on because it was just assumed that there would only be one candidate. And I think they've been walking that back slightly to retain a little bit more neutral air. But in the end, even an endorsement from Obama, I don't think is really going to decide this. And Clinton's great advantage is just that machinery that is required to win some of these primaries, the money that she's raising, all of which Joe Biden would be playing catch up on. The wild card is Bernie Sanders, who is managing, like Obama, to run a very different campaign, one that is kind of reliant on buzz and excitement and small individual donations. Even his biggest fans will say he doesn't look terribly presidential. It's quite hard to imagine Bernie Sanders in the Oval Office. But it is not hard to imagine him completely upsetting the apple cart here, and whether that's by opening the door for somebody else to come in, whether that's just weakening Hillary to the point where she's just unable to win the general, even if she wins the primary, he is showing up her lack of authenticity and passion in a way that Ewan identifies, or her displayed authenticity and passion. Who knows what she's really like? But I think the other thing about this email saga is that although there are no great smoking guns, it has played into those same concerns that the Clintons operate in a world where there's one rule for them, one rule for everybody else. There was a terrible moment a few days back where she was asked to about whether she had wiped the hard drive of her personal email server before handing it over. And she kind of tried to shock it off with a joke, but it came across as incredibly complacent. She said, "What, wiped what, like with a cloth?" And, you know, it was just one of those moments where she was either kind of incredibly arrogant or ignorant or both, but it was just came across as someone who's basically, "I don't have to answer your questions. I don't have to justify this." And that really, I think, riles a lot of people and plays into some of the concerns people have about, you know, what is she really doing this for? Is she doing this because she's passionate about changing America, or is she doing this because she wants to be president?
And I suppose, I mean, the question is, if she is damaged by Saunders, and if Saunders is mostly a kind of, I don't know if this is right, but a kind of college town kind of effect rather than someone who could command real support in middle America, the question becomes who is there apart from maybe Biden who might be able to come through, you know, when Clinton's damaged?
Quite. I mean, I think the big unknown is Elizabeth Warren, the Massachusetts senator, who, like Bernie Sanders, is exciting the left, but is perhaps a little, I would say, a conventional politician, but she has a little more polish than Sanders. And, you know, she's always said she doesn't want to run, and I think people have by and large believe that now. But she had a meeting recently with Joe Biden, and it's not inconceivable that they could form some kind of partnership, that she might be his running mate, or, you know, she represents a type of figure who could enter the race, who could, I think still shake things up. As Ewan said at the outset, we're so early on in this that almost anything can happen right now.
Ewan, have you followed Sanders before? Do you think he's a little bit like a Jeremy Corbyn figure, or is he more of a sort of, I don't know, Neil Kinnock or something?
No, he's a Jeremy Corbyn type figure. I mean, it's astonishing. I mean, the word socialism in America just goes down badly. Even in liberal circles, most people wouldn't identify themselves as socialists. So for Bernie Sanders, has long described himself as a democratic socialist. So for him to be attracting huge crowds of 10,000 in Iowa and New Hampshire and Arizona and other places, you know, and Clinton doesn't even match that. So there's a parallels with what's happening with Jeremy Corbyn. Again, he's quite proud of the fact he's a socialist and he's attracting big audiences. Ever since I covered politics in the States, Bernie Sanders has been on my email list, so I get emails from him on a regular basis. But as a political correspondent, I basically used to ignore them because he was never part of the mainstream debate. And I sort of regret now that I hadn't given him a bit more space. But I always thought he was so far in the fringes, so far out there, he was never going to have an impact.
He has a tremendous appeal, I think, not just because of what he stands for, but the way he presents it. I think that he's quite dour. He doesn't sort of crack jokes and smile, but he's also fantastically un-spin doctored. And I think there's a yearning for that here, and as I'm sure there is in the UK. And I just think there's such anger at the divisions of the spoils in the economy, and the sense that we might be heading back towards a recession, or the economic cycle might be turning, and yet the middle class don't even feel like they've seen any benefits from the last 6 or 7 years of recovery. And that, I think, fundamentally can carry people a long way. And I think there is a sense in which, yes, America is traditionally to the right of European politics and British politics, but there is also a sort of a very strong belief in the American dream that is in danger of being shattered right now. And I wouldn't underestimate the extent to which that can galvanise people to take some quite unpredictable and extreme positions.
Yeah. Just to pick up on what Dan said, the political playbook in the US and the UK for at least two decades now is, you know, focus groups, spin, politicians being careful what they say, fairly anodyne remarks, you know, don't alienate people, don't be too strident, don't take too strong a position. And there's just a kickback against that. And, you know, as Dan said, it's Saunders is the anti-spin. We're seeing that here as well. And it's I think... when I started to watch the other Labour candidates, other than Corbyn, I was irritated by them because they were still, you know, they're
watching being cautious, their back.
Yeah, watching their back. And I think the public have got fed up with that.
Is there something, though, Dan, I mean, in America now, after we had, you know, this promises in 2008 that that Obama was going to be a transformational president, you know, the whole system would change and we'd have healthcare and climate change and all these things. Most of it didn't happen because of gridlock in Congress. And I think people sort of tend to think that that's not going to go away. The pattern has been in recent decades that Congress and the White House are gridlocked across party lines more than they're not. And do you think maybe America's starting to think you can have a bit more fun with who you put in the presidency than you would have done 40 or 50 years ago?
I think that's I certainly would buy the thesis that the president, that Obama, has shown just how impotent a president can be in the face of a political opposition in Congress. I think also he has reminded people that you can't achieve change just with one man, that or woman, and that you have to build a movement, and that movement has to involve electing officials right up and down, not just Senate and House, but also at state level. And my worry about Bernie Sanders is that he's not particularly doing that. He's very similar to Obama in that he's got this, you know, this cult of personality around him at the moment, and his ability to really affect change on his own, I think, would be pretty limited. But I think there is the fact that he's surged so far. Points to the fact there is a movement there if somebody can build on it, and that unfortunately, until now, people have been quite disaffected with the Democratic Party and the Democratic machine as a means to achieving that. But just maybe like Corbyn and Labour, if Sanders can, who was previously an independent senator, he's only just started seeking the Democratic nomination. But if he can kind of take that party machinery and trying to build a broader Elizabeth Warren wing of the party, I think there is a chance that he could achieve something were in the unlikely event he became president.
I would part company with Dan on this. I think Obama has been a pretty good president. You know, when you look at just to achieve healthcare, if nothing else, the way he took America out of the slump faster than Europe, the cultural changes with attitudes towards gay rights, the deal with Iran. I mean, there's loads and loads of things if you put them together. But Dan's right. There is a disappointment in America. He's seen as underperformed and been a disappointment. And against that, that begs the question, is America ready to elect another Democrat off the back of the Obama, two-term Democratic president? So even if it's Clinton, the fact that you've had this disappointment with Obama, it could make it very difficult for, you know, whether it's Clinton or Biden.
I think that's right. I mean, just one point of clarification. I share Ewan's enthusiasm for Obama on certainly on foreign policy. Healthcare is a big achievement. I think the fundamental thing is, though, that American society hasn't changed. The economy hasn't changed dramatically. Yes, there's been a few social trends, such as the sort of growing acceptance of gay rights and things, but I don't think Obama's really been responsible for that. I think he's ridden it. And there is there is a hunger for something different. My personal prediction is what will happen here is I think that Hillary will get the Democratic nomination, but she'll be weakened to the extent that she won't win the general, and that somebody new and different will emerge out of the Republican melee and surprise us. And whether that might be Marco Rubio, it might be Scott Walker, but I think that it quite might well be that the next change candidate does come from the right.
Well, with Dan putting his money where his mouth is, or his mouth where his money is, we'll leave that there for now. But there's plenty more on this as we head into the primary season at theguardian.com.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you want to build a website, you've got many options. But if you want to build it beautiful, there's only one. Squarespace gives you the power of world-class design so you can do more than create a website. You can set yourself apart. See why some of the world's most influential people, brands, and businesses choose Squarespace. To start your free trial, head to squarespace.com/guardian.
Now to Northern Ireland, where a new political crisis is raging ahead of the opening of the Stormont Parliament next week. The Ulster Unionist Party have walked out of the power-sharing executive after allegations of Republican violence were linked to the provisional IRA. Earlier, I spoke to our Ireland correspondent, Henry McDonnell, and asked him whether the provisional IRA are still operational and whether they could bring the Northern Irish government down.
What seems to be emerging is that there is some kind of structure. This is what the Chief Constable of Northern Ireland, George Hamilton, said a fortnight ago. There's still some sort of a shell-like provisional IRA organisation, and it's being blamed for a revenge killing back in the middle of August of a former member of the organisation called Kevin McGuigan. And this killing on the streets of Belfast, which again the Chief Constable said was carried out by members of the Provisional IRA, or veterans, if you like, of that organisation, begs a lot of questions. Did it go away as a complete organisation? Does it still have access to guns? Why were guns produced when we were told there was a big arsenal of weaponry decommissioned as part of a series of moves towards power sharing between unionists and nationalists and republicans? And this is why we're in this political crisis, because the unionists are saying this is a breach of faith of that agreement towards the latter end of the first decade of the 21st century, that we were assuming that there had been no more killings and there would be no more guns on the streets. And this is the product today, where we have massive instability in the power-sharing devolved government.
And the trigger between this being a scandal about law enforcement, the police and this undercover organisation, and then the crisis at Stormont, was the smaller of the two unionist parties, the old official unionist party, saying it was going to resign. Is that right?
That's right. Their leader, Mike Nesbitt, a former television news presenter, took the decision last week that enough was enough. They could no longer share power with Sinn Féin in the five-party coalition in Belfast. Unlike Wales and Cardiff in the devolved government, it's worth pointing out, Northern Ireland is a mandatory coalition. Parties have to stick together, and there has to be enough cross-community, i.e. Catholic, Protestant or Unionist nationalist support for that government to be legitimate. But the Ulster Unionists have done something that they've been kind of threatening to do even before this crisis began, which is to form an opposition. Now, since power sharing was restored almost 10 years ago, there has been no opposition. There are two members of the 100-plus Assembly who sit on the opposition benches. They're independents. And we now have an official opposition, but it has massively destabilised power sharing, because the other bigger unionist party, the Democratic Unionist Party, which was of course founded by the late Ian Paisley, are spooked by the Ulster Unionist exit stage left from the government, and are now considering their position in this coalition. And they're coming under their leadership are coming under massive internal pressure to pull out as well.
So if this one minister from the Ulster Unionist rather than the Democratic Unionist Party, if this one minister walked out, if the Democratic Unionists wanted to stay on, then they'd have the numbers, they'd be able to keep going.
Absolutely, Tom. They could easily hoover up that transport ministry and keep on going, but they've been reluctant to do so. Peter Robinson basically was in Downing Street yesterday trying to get support from David Cameron to suspend, to put into cold storage the Assembly, because this crisis is going to reach another important crossing point on Monday, because the Assembly comes back after the summer recess. And Peter Robinson said, well, it's not going to be business as usual. But what does he mean by that? He wants a four-week period of negotiations to sort this problem out. The other parties have said no, and now it's in the Prime Minister's ball court. What's he going to do? Can he use powers at Westminster to suspend the institutions, impose temporary direct rule? It's all a mess, and it's heading towards a major crisis on Monday.
So we're about to see how far the two unionist parties are going to push things to the brink in outstaring each other. What about on the other side of the aisle? Are the Sinn Féin kind of making the half excuses for the IRA that they always used to do?
Well, Sinn Féin are saying basically that this is more to do with inter-unionist rivalry and electoral politics. They're claiming that the Ulster Unionists have jumped out of government to outflank the DUP. Remember, there are assembly elections to the Stormont Parliament in May next year. And they're basically saying that they're putting in danger these institutions because of narrow political gain. They're also saying Martin McGuinness, Deputy First Minister, stated quite candidly yesterday that, you know, the last thing David Cameron should do is suspend the institutions, and cause, which would cause massive instability. So they're pretty adamant that we keep on going, and that this killing doesn't, you know, throw people. Of course, Sinn Féin deny that the Provisional IRA members were involved in the McGuigan murder, although his family believe they were. So there's a whole kind of catcalling of denial and counter-denial going on here. But it is worth, I think, noting this. It is a supreme irony that unionists could, en masse, could be walking out of a power-sharing government over the death of an IRA man who was, quite frankly, an assassin in the 1990s for that organisation, and would have had no hesitation attacking unionists had he been told to do so. It's one of the supreme ironies of this peace process situation we're in.
It's been a tortuous process to get this assembly up and running 10 years ago or so, and to have it working all this time. It's looked in jeopardy once or twice before, but do you think it's going to get sorted out again this time, or do you think this could be, you know, leading to something much more serious?
Well, when I heard Peter Robinson echoing the likes of ex-First Minister and one-time rival Lord Trimble, who won the Nobel Peace Prize with John Hume for the Good Friday Agreement of 1998, when Trimble suggested, and Robinson supported the idea, of some mechanism to bolster confidence back in the unionist community, for example, a monitoring commission that would examine the status of ceasefires and acts of individual violence that went on in the near future. That suggested to me that Robinson was looking for a way to save things, to bring things back from the brink. And this has been done before. Things like the International Monitoring Commission, that's a body of security experts that was brought in to oversee alleged breaches of the IRA ceasefire, and indeed the loyalists too. That was brought in to save the process over 10 years ago. And to hear people like Peter Robinson suggesting, let's create the son of IMC, IMC Mark II, that suggests to me that they are keener to keep the process going, to find some mechanism to rebuild trust with unionists and Republicans. So my best guess is, although it might go into cold storage, the Parliament and the devolved institutions, post the elections in May, I think we'll be back again at a fresh round of negotiations leading to the resumption of devolution. No one wants the devolved institutions to fall in reality among the political classes in Belfast. So although we're going to have a very turbulent period starting on Monday, I still think the desired position of the likes of the DUP is to try and save it.
Henry McDonald there. Well, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to Henry, to Dan, and to Ewan. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.